welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. In this episode, we have an in-depth discussion about the future of work with Marina Pullen. Marina works with some of Australia's largest organisations, helping them take the step towards commercial innovation. She also invented a platform called Jungle, a private platform to match great people with great opportunities. Marina is at the intersection of our transforming world of work. We talk about the move towards the gig economy, the rapidly growing workforce of independent workers who take up short-term contracts instead of typical full-time employment. We talk about the opportunities and threats that the gig economy brings for workers, companies, and even governments. We also talk about what work will look like in the decades ahead, the scary potential impact of computers on jobs, what leadership and culture looks like with transient staff, and much more. Enjoy our chat with Marina Pullen at the MCBI offices. Marina, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, my daughter is 8 weeks old. Mm-hmm. She's going to hopefully enter the workforce about 2040-ish. Mm-hmm. What's the world going to be like for her? What's it going to look and feel like?
That's a really big question. So looking at the facts and I guess where the trends are going, a lot of futurists are saying that at least 50% of the jobs that your daughter will be, you know, looking to interview, looking for, haven't been invented yet. So I can't actually tell you what the jobs are. I can probably take a punt that the composition of the workforce is going to look really different to how you and I might experience the workforce. She's probably going to be working alongside robots, which will be different for us, you know, than from us. She'll probably have a lot more she'll be probably working across a whole lot of, is that person really loud? Sorry.
No, we like a bit of atmosphere.
It's fine.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
No, if there's a bit of background.
Do you know who it is?
Do you recognise the voice?
Yeah.
You
can, no, I don't.
No, talk. Okay. Yeah, you can.
I actually don't know who that is. That's no surprise here. Who's here? Sorry. Do you want me to keep going?
Maybe a question also, which is interesting, is we're groomed from, you know, year 9, year 10 to pick your career, pick your industry. Yeah. What do you think the sort of education pathway is going to be like to equip kids to move into a world of gig economy and robots?
So I'm not sure that the education system of Australia in particular is really giving our kids a fighting chance. There's the gig economy and the new world of work is a lot more transparent than ever before, than we've probably ever seen over the history of work. If you don't do a good job on a gig, you're out. So the competition to demonstrate skills is probably going to be overtaken by your capacity to actually deliver something, which is really different to the way we groom our kids. We tell them to go get parchments, and we tell them to go to uni, and we tell them to go get all these credentials. But we're not probably telling them how to be resilient and to enjoy work, like actually enjoy it. And I think Australia is well behind in particular.
Who are some of the leaders?
You know, so this is an off the cuff, but I think those countries who have lower socioeconomic status, where there's more competition for work, they don't have the luxury of choice like we do, so they don't get that sort of, dare I say, a bit of entitled, I don't want that work type of thing, I'll go to something else. You know, those guys have got a hunger that we don't have anymore. You know, they just don't have it. But technology is going to unleash that workforce on all of us who are a bit softer, dare I say it. But I think at the core of it, you have to love work. Like you have to get off on it and actually feel good about it. Whereas I'm just not sure we're doing that for our kids.
So it looks like education isn't up to speed yet. You've touched on the human side of it. So we talk about needing to upskill our kids in the right way for this evolution of work. How do we upskill our kids from a human perspective? What mindset should we be coaching them towards? How should they be thinking about work instead of, you know, getting that safe government job or that long-term corporate job. How do we need to start thinking about that?
I'm not sure long-term corporate jobs are going to exist anymore. We're seeing trends already, like the beginning of the future is already happening, where really clever, skilled people, they're not interested in being a part of a big corporation. Mm. They'll go out and, you know, back themselves. The year of the entrepreneur is evidence of it. I think for kids, though, we've got to reset this, you know, reset their mind in so many ways that that they're going to be famous or they're going to be wealthy or, you know, we should push all that aside. And it might sound really old-fashioned, but an idea. I grew up in very much working class, but I remember being deeply impressed with how proud my father and my grandmother, all of them were about getting promoted. Because in that era, it was a lot more real. You know, it wasn't all this politicking and all this, you know, it was like, you did a good job, you actually got promoted. But the self-esteem they got, and I think we should be doing that type of mature, sophisticated building in our kids. I don't know if I'm explaining it very well.
No, absolutely.
But build your self-esteem by being great at your job. Not asking for praise, but actually being great, which is different, totally different mindset. And yeah.
My mum's a teacher and a proud sort of, when I say unionist, you know, she believes in the collective bargaining and the power of a group of people. And initially she just hated the idea of Uber. She, on principle, you know, thought that we're going to, so this is the beginning of the end really in terms of workers' rights and entitlements. How do you perceive the tension between sort of minimum standards and this idea of on-demand work?
Yeah, the Uberization of work, as they call it. I think it's funny enough, I think the collective bargaining and a lot of the industrial relations laws that we operate, particularly in Australia, they've been built up over the best part of a century, and many of them are actually, funny enough, the accelerant that will be ultimately leading to their own decline because it's just too hard to deal with them. You know, we're seeing huge quantities of underemployment, casual workers, and everyone's just skirting around to avoid some of these really bad IR laws. And the funny thing is, this gig economy and on demand provides extraordinary opportunity. It's an amazing opportunity. It picks up capacity in our overall workforce, and we are able to use it as a society. We can forget about whether you're retired or not. We can not worry if you work from home or not. All of that stuff's gone, and we can create new work, new styles of work. But at the moment, the industrial relations laws haven't got their head around that, and we don't need a tweaking. We actually need a new set of laws that reflect this totally different way of looking at work. There are a couple of really practical things, if I may, like just throw in there, like the work is going to evolve with or without compliance, with or without scrutiny. It's going to happen. It has happened. It has happened for 100 years. But unless we get our heads around this, things like superannuation for workers, that we're not going to deal with it sensibly. You know, we're going to try to use an old-fashioned model, and we'll ruin it. Because if you're a gigster, right, you're a side hustler, why would you pay a premium to an Australian platform when you can just go click, click, and go an American one and get no tax, get a better benefit, and not have to worry about all that stuff? Like, you would. You just move on it. But that has big implications for Australia, our PAYG. A whole lot of other stuff starts to fall apart unless these guys get their head around how this is like a seismic shift.
Mm.
But they're not. They're thinking, oh, no, it's like, you know, Uber, and it's not. It is definitely not. And it's frustrating sometimes to hear the low-level debate on it.
It's actually just reminded me of an article that I read last week that I sent to you that you wouldn't have bothered to read, though, because you never read.
That's not me you're saying.
No,
just for clarity.
it was almost the step beyond the gig economy. Well, it's all wrapped into it. And it's also that I've just had a mental blank about the
great story so far.
No, we always talk about it. The Workers moving around, working from overseas. Come on.
Oh, nomads.
The digital nomads.
Yeah, digital nomads. Yeah, yeah.
So this growth of digital nomads means that people can now shop for countries.
Correct.
As part of this. So correct. If Australia isn't up to speed in terms of laws and creating an environment for gigsters, as you say, well, then they'll just go to another country.
That's what they're doing.
And all that income and all that potential revenue goes with them.
All that structure that goes into our
system. So it was a poor lead into the question, but I got there in the end.
No, you're absolutely right. That's what they're doing. We call them here at MCBI noetic nomads, which is, it's Latin, you know, wanky, but it's the smart nomads. And they walk through that front door and you go, so where do you live? And they go, ah, no fixed address. I'm a mathematician. I just came back from 2 months in Bali. I'm off to Amsterdam. Don't worry, I'll log on from home, wherever my home is for that moment.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's, and then you look at the crazy opportunity and risk to governments as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a smart and savvy government, you set up this environment to welcome these people, all of a sudden you're creating huge opportunity.
Massive.
But
what
you're actually asking of government is to act in an agile way, because it's not just about gig economy. It's about how you deal with technology businesses. It's new technologies coming. It's their ability to react, and they're terrible at it.
They are. I don't know if you've seen the state government, South Australian government's come under scrutiny for introducing one of the most archaic, inhibiting pieces of legislation. I just laughed when I saw it.
Are you laughing or crying?
I just looked and went, man, it's like it's a dystopian existence here. You worked real hard to make it that bad. And they did, because it is this old-fashioned mindset on a new business model.
So what is it? What's the...
They're trying to, the irony in it is that they're trying to legislate and scrutinise labour hire, and they're trying to scoop up some of this, you know, this more itinerant worker type of thing. The minor, the big area that's being exploited at the moment are like the poultry farmers and the immigrants. Mm. Yeah, no, they excluded that from the guidelines. Do you reckon there might have been a pressure to do it? Like, I read it and went, wow, that's really stupid. But it's also really dangerous because what it does, it creates the illusion of governance. It creates the illusion that we've got some credentials around this, and it's not. And no one likes detail. But when you read it, you go, nah, those guys are going to get exploited. Yeah.
This is all getting a bit depressing. but no, it's great stuff, because I'm keen to talk about MCBI.
Yeah.
And,
it's all about
people. The off the wall.
Only because I'm thinking of, MIBT or MBIT, you know, the humanistic
Myers-Briggs
stuff. Yes. Yeah. So sorry, I'm just getting my acronym right, but. And I'm sure that, you know, the gig economy and the new world is going to feature, I guess, in your business and the business model. Give us the genesis. Where did this process begin?
Like for us, our platform. So we've built a platform, the award-winning Jungle platform.
It's a good name too, really, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. Thanks. Yeah.
The Jungle.
It was invented on the couch at home, literally with the red wine. And it was a working title, but it does capture actually the essence of that real, you're in it. You're in this jungle out there. I think we're probably one of very few Australian digital platforms. This started 4 years ago for us, where we could see the trends emerging around it's sort of like two forces where companies didn't want to hire people in a permanent basis. Their appetite for developing people who perhaps weren't that interested in developing themselves was declining. And then we had this emergence of this sort of, you know, these nomads appearing. I was extremely interested, and always have been, around what happens next on it. And probably adding to that, I'm not a big fan of that transaction creating exploitation for the worker, which it does. So that transaction is normally dealt with by a recruitment firm or a body shopper or someone like that. And they can pay the person like $10, but then they sell the stock or the product or the person for $100. There's something about the inequity that really bothers me, because the way it is all done bothers me. But for clients, I've always felt really passionate that they should have better visibility of who they're hiring, not just of glossed up which is a polished up version of it. There should be more transparency. So it was based on that, I came up with this completely insane idea. I went, let's bring this whole thing together online and let's see what we can do. And we're all forward. We're about to, release another version of The Jungles going out. We've got corporate clients now using it who've entrusted the platform to, source people. The workers get a 20% uplift straight away on their cost, and the cost to the company is dropped. So it's everyone wins. It's Uber.
So yeah. So can you give us, you don't have to give names, but what's some good examples, some practical examples of, I guess, some of the transactions and the people kind of using the system?
So without giving too many names away, we've got a client here in Adelaide who's, they're really progressive and they like doing edgy, bold things. But rather than pay for a whole team of people, that they, and all the hassle that goes with that, and keeping currency, they partner with us and they use the jungle people to actually help them deliver their vision and their idea. So they have access to 10 people who know them inside and out, but they buy them on demand. We look after the cohort, the 10 people here. So they drift in. That's all those people you see drifting in and out. They have a home. They have a professional home to hang out in with other like-minded professionals. And this corporate is, they're thrilled. I hope that explained it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It feels to me like a true sort of business of the future. You're providing some framework and some quality and some vetting, but you acknowledge the kind of ebb and flow of demand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, I started my career in global companies, and I think it shaped me a lot because we worked around the clock all the time. You know, we always follow the sun. The idea of the 9-to-5, I never understood it. And more, I look at how people want to work now and they don't want that. Mm. It's just crazy. And what we know about humans too, they don't like being put into a box.
So what sort of workers are you most commonly seeing engaging your platform?
Mainly white collar workers, mm-hmm. I'd say. We're also probably our brand and our we're known for being the smart guys, and the smart talent on the block. I love the nerds that hang out here. I find them the talent that is amazing, you know, the brains trust, as we call them. But a lot of them are really, really smart. So lots of business analysts, consultants, data scientists, mathematicians. We're suddenly cool. People have sort of figured out they're actually a mathematician or, you know, someone who can show you the analytics or something. Actually, you know, we can move your company around. It's okay.
For those that can't hear, there's some just incidental applause in the background. Any marketplace, I mean, it might not be, you know, necessarily just a true public marketplace, but in some respects, you're bringing together two stakeholders.
Yeah. Ours is private.
Yeah. Is never easy. You're addressing two stakeholders. And so, well, how easy has it been to lurch between the workers and the clients?
Yeah, it's not. It's really not, because digital platforms, they're like everything. They go through a product life cycle. I made the decision that we would preserve our brand of being high quality, high integrity, which means some of the automation opportunities, we have to put it on hold, and you can't substitute the human verification process. Which can be quite frustrating for the board and frustrating for my colleagues, but it's proving that it works, because the magic is actually the people part of it. So the platform becomes the enabler, and that's its rightful place as an enabler. It doesn't take away the humanness part of that relationship, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm assuming, you know, that you might have visions of scaling out and, you know, being in other places. I mean, does that also then change your business model? I mean, do you have little hubs in each place that you want to bring the workers together?
Yeah. So we're in the process of spinning the company out at the moment. too, not just for Australia, but into Asia as well, which is a different set of joy and excitement and long hours. It's a true hybrid system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the evolution of it, what's been some of the barriers? I mean, any disrupt or any person that's trying to do something a bit different is going to come up against some things which they've got to battle against.
I reckon the very first one was starting 4 years ago, and I remember sitting and trying to explain this to someone and going, and they're like, what? What? And there is those moments in your career where you go, no, I have nothing other than intuition here. I'm doing the right thing. And then I went, oh, let's put a whole lot of my own money onto this bet. Let's do that. Yeah, great. And explaining a business model that is so fundamentally different to people who don't get it, that's the hard part.
You've got to day in, day out.
And yet now, like now, they just go, yeah, no, I got that. And which is good, but that's probably the first part. And I think that's the same battle the legislators, all of them, are having, because it takes so long to shift the mindset. But I just had that. Yeah, well, I got other plans next.
So, I mean, to maybe go back to what we were talking about earlier, but what industries have been hit first by the gig economy and this shift in work? Yeah. And then the second part of the question is, what industries are next?
Oh, okay. All right, so probably the first, I would say, would have been during probably the 90s, when we saw large-scale outsourcing, you know, the EDSs and the IBMs and Hewlett-Packards taking IT and putting it over in India and the Philippines in call centres. So that's sort of like the beginning of it, where we broke a supply chain. And then there was some value between the two corporates, you know, transitioning the risk, and I could do it. But then the model proved itself, so it evolved now into individuals doing it. So it's been tested and proven. The first ones that flipped over were really the graphic designers, you know, the techos, all of that. And even now there's a lot of like Upwork and Fiverr. They're all dominated by quick and easy transactions on it. But if you look at some of the what's happening next, accounting's going. That's all starting to erode and fall into the automation and the gig economy. Law is as well. Mm-hmm. Even ones where people go, what? That's impossible. That's all going to. Engineering, health has already got a foot on either side, where you can do telehealth overseas.
So, I'm even thinking media.
Oh, media is gone. Yeah. But it's been coming for a long time.
It feels like it comes for a long time, but then when it hits, it can actually happen very quickly.
It's like this critical mass hits. Mm. And so it's,
someone here.
Yeah.
G'day, mate.
Oh, my car. Sorry. Yeah, my handbag. Have a look. That's all right. Everyone likes me. Oh, it's hanging up.
This is Rooster Radio at its best. This is kind of what happens in our interviews. Just someone's collecting Marina's car keys. I thought you would have sold your car and just
I thought you'd be exclusively
on Uber by now. Or
no, that's my car downstairs right at the front.
When I was doing a little bit of research ahead of this interview, I found something where you were talking about how close computers can go to actually emulating the human brain. Okay. So people will say, you know, a lot of people do say, well, you know, computers will never be able to do this, and this like a human can. How far can it go?
It can go all the way.
Yeah. That's creativity?
Yeah. Because intelligence is defined as being able to piece together two bits of weird information and come up with something novel. It's a transaction. You know, we don't think it is, because we think we're terribly clever because it's the first time we came up with it. But the sad part about it is there's two forces at play. Computers will mimic us, because in some ways we're quite basic. Otherwise we're terribly clever. But the one big limitation with us being number one is, we're only useful for about 40, 50 years. So I don't know if you've, in maths, there's a thing called recency bias, which means we only, so data, we only recall what's happened over the last, you know, short period of time, and you get data sets that will skew. So as we get computers and robots that are learning for more than 40 years, they will become superior to us. And it's transactional and binary. And it's, they're going to win. It's terrible.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is that people are getting less interested in flaws of humans. So like a doctor, I've got a 19-year-old son, and he comes from family doctors as well. And if you say to him, oh, no, you need to go to the GP to diagnose. And he looks at you like, yeah, nah, I'd rather just go to a stall and like wee into a cup and get a computer to tell me exactly what's wrong with me. Not some dude who might have had been drinking the night before. So the variation that we all love in humanity, some people don't like it.
I did hear a podcast with a neuroscientist talk about, you know, he was at the end of his career, and he was very much saying that as he's delved into the human brain, you really do work out that there's kind of cause and effect, and there's, you know, electrical stimulus, and there's chemicals, and, you know, hormones, and it's not magical. It's a machine, a very complex one. And he chooses not to think about it too much because he likes the fact that there might be some mystery in there. But in effect, he was saying what you're saying, which it can at some point, and at some point can be mimicked to some degree. What do you see as the opportunities then, the good things about where this might go into the future?
If we play it right, there's a lot of trends and, you know, a lot of people, which I probably agree with, that the creatives, as they call them, the creative class, will reemerge.
It might be like the Renaissance again.
Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Well, when you think about it, like all this automation being taken care of, I mean, we have robots to do the robotic things. Our life should become less robotic. You have all these people doing robot jobs.
Provided we don't let them take over authority stuff but you're right, that's it. And I like that idea. I like that concept. I'll probably like the neuroscientists push away some of the dark parts of the whole story, because in reality, we're not going to be able to change a lot of this. It's already 20 years old. We just haven't seen it yet. Yeah.
So we can't make ourselves indisposable. So we can only really make ourselves useful for a short period of time. I'm just trying to think, what would be the least indisposable worker going forward?
I asked my sons that. I said, what do you reckon? And like the answer was artists, painters who have pain or joy, and that they can put it into something, a unique moment in time that we appreciate. There's probably others, but I went, yeah, I reckon you're right. It's actually quite limited on it. But that moment of when someone can capture something human and put it into art.
I can't
think of too many others.
No, I just had a thought though.
Detail.
Why are you laughing, Andrew? Could artificial intelligence or robots become consumers?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I'm probably on behalf, on behalf of someone else, maybe. I'm not sure they do it in their own right, maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I'd have to think about that. Oh, I like that. Thanks.
Maybe that's part two.
I have to think about that.
I can just picture Johnny number five. Andrew, you're a bit young for this, but when I was growing up, there was a movie and there was a robot. It's called Johnny number five. He's cruising around. I can just picture him going to a shop and wanting to sort of add on a bit of a extra hard drive or, you know, going.
But that would put,
Think about it. If you're a robot and you've got some form of intelligence,
you'd want to boost it.
Well, you'd want to boost it, wouldn't you?
If you had a desire to compete. See, robots don't have that. We've got that.
But if they take on the sort of our humanistic traits through the, I guess,
I don't know either.
I'm speaking completely out of my depth here.
It is an interesting world though, but I'm not sure anyone really knows where this stuff's going to land. I do think there's some big social issues. And, you know, Mr. Gates has come out, you know, and he's been really strong saying some of the worst decisions in humanity being made at the moment.
Like what?
Like, so he was saying that we should all tax companies who have a high proportion of robots in there. It's called like substitution, where you take a human and we'll give you a smart person, knock you out and put a robot back in. He was saying, and Stephen Hawkins have said similar things, that you should, get heavily taxed for that. And really what they're trying to do is slow down the adoption of robots through our workforce. Like, really trying to slow it down.
Easy for him to say, isn't it?
It is, but they're right, because there's a lot of those middle class jobs and those robot, you know, those entry level jobs, they're all gone. And it's not gone because they've gone to some other country. They've gone to robots, or we're just doing things differently. Yeah. Which is scary.
Have you seen the TV show Westworld?
No.
Oh, you have to see it. We can't talk about
Westworld.
It now,
okay.
I'm the only one that's no. Westworld. Is that dystopian future?
Oh, I can't only handle it for so long, because then I come back and you're like,
ah. Yeah. We have, I think a great example of all of this is we've got a business next door to us. They're the next generation of accountants.
So they've got a
team in Manila.
Okay.
And, you know, they're very upfront with their clients, and they're really changing the model, which is fantastic. That's more using their smarts to work with their clients in the areas that count rather than just doing data entry. But their gap that already exists is that they are finding it hard to bring on juniors, because juniors traditionally have built your crafts by doing the rote things.
Yeah.
And they said, well, none of the juniors want to do that stuff.
No.
And it's easier for us to get it done elsewhere.
Correct.
And so all of a sudden there's like this gap, this chasm now in the pipeline of accountants.
Yeah. It's across many industries. It's like the attractiveness of substitution. So if you are just, you know, there's competition everywhere now for your jobs, and other countries will do it, other ways of doing it. But if you have those two options in front of you as a business owner, someone who's just high maintenance, hard to deal with, has limited skills, da 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 da, and that might cost you $100, just pure cash here, and then the other one is $10, there's a lot of risk that you're prepared to take on to try to close that gap. You know, that. And a lot of people aren't seeing the globalization is, you're not just competing with the guy up the street now. You're competing with the guys in Manila or Latvia or, you know, wherever now. It's full on, yeah.
There's also the speed at which universities are cranking out graduates for jobs that don't exist or won't exist. Like law is a classic example where they're churning out grads. There are no jobs. The grads then say, well, there's no jobs for me. There's no lawyer jobs for me. Oh, well, why don't you get a double degree, or why don't you get a master's? And that's like, there's a massive disconnect between education and the real world at the moment.
Yep. And they've been able to transform knowledge into proper education. Yeah, they can't keep up. Mm. I'm back at uni again. It's horrifying. But I'm back doing blockchain, and it was like going back to 1991, first year uni, going ugh. And the way that they were teaching hadn't improved a lot. It was still by rote. The only part that was really, really good out of those first few lectures I've been to so far is that they brought in lawyers who had these weird, they were ands. I call them and people. So he's a lawyer and a technologist and an economist.
Mm.
And he's like, and I think there's more of these weirdos, like weirdos, not
a slashy.
A slashy,
Not a purebreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, I found one in, last year.
Zoolander,
in Sydney.
Model slash actor.
Yeah. She was, she had a nursing degree and was an engineer. And I was like, that's a weird combo. But when she talked.
Amazing.
Yeah. And we were at a, health hack, and she was awesome. Like, I think there's more weird connections now on it. But the education system,
The other.
I shouldn't say that. It's great.
Great Australian phrase.
Yeah, nah. I love that. Yeah. I love
Yeah, nah. The other interesting aspect of this is the inability for some businesses to transform themselves for this new era, which is obviously the space that your business sits in. Can you maybe give us some context about what you've noticed from a corporate perspective in terms of that scariness, the scary jump from going to, you know, paper-driven firm with X thousands of employees to actually transforming to a truly technology-driven company?
So first up, I'd say a lot of leaders don't understand economics as a cycle. That's probably a big one. So you find yourself talking to people and they're like, oh, you know, it's this change, this disruption and da-da-da, it's all new and it's like this brand new. You're like, no, actually, no. If you go to creative destruction theory, which was back in the 1930s, this is just a cycle we're on. And if you go back and you take advantage of everyone else's knowledge, you'll realize that the big guys who are, it's not so much their size, it's their inability to absorb new ideas from the market inwards. That's actually the problem. It's their, I sometimes call it like their immune system. It actually repels innovation. And unless you lead a company with that sort of concept in mind, you get distracted and you think that it's change resistant and all that. You go, actually, no, that's the way you've been leading. But creative destruction means that there's always adjustments to our economy. So there's these schisms that happen. So if you're a great leader and you know what's going on, you're not afraid of it. You know, like I reckon the next 2-3 years, it's a free kick. Anyone in a Western economy, like it's going to be hard not to make money unless you're really, really stupid. Because we've got this synchronicity going on economically globally. So everyone's going to be making money, moving stuff around. And then it will probably, there'll be an adjustment. But this is cycles. And I think if you know it's a cycle, you can lead better and take your people through changes easier. And you're not as afraid to like go from paper to digital because you actually know we need to do this better. I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling a bit.
It really is a fascinating point. Who are the leaders, I think, that you use as sort of talisman or great examples of people who have adapted or, incorporated this change mentality?
I've got my little calendar of awesome people. I like old practical rules. So I'm a massive fan of Warren Buffett. And I think if you just like, and he was an Edison fan, I think. Because there are just basic laws of trade that will never change. That one, I like all his stuff. Even though he can't figure out crypto, which is sort of interesting. I do like, even though I sort of like him, but I don't. I like Steve Jobs, but I don't. Like, I have this real...
What are the tensions?
I like the fact he had the conviction and he had the aggression sometimes to push through and to chase stuff down when everyone else was giving up. And I think he's awesome how he figured out how to get the smartest people on the block to work for him. I think that's great on it. But I just have this, some of his style I don't like. And maybe his style was appropriate for 80s and 90s, and I'm judging it by 2018 standards, which is more about equality and density of smartness.
What about a female version?
Oh, so I'm a big fan. I can't remember her name. God, how can I?
If you can describe IMF. Her, and then we might guess.
No, the managing director of IMF.
Oh, Christina Lagarde.
Yeah, Lagarde. Yeah. I love Christina Lagarde. Yeah. How can I forget her? I love how she uses her wit and her intelligence to navigate something really hard. And I like the fact that she doesn't, she's doing a lot of work for helping underdeveloped countries. And she's doing a lot of work, obviously, for women and trying to bring some level of equity back to the world. But she's not doing it, I think of her more as a knight on the chessboard. Like she does it and she's smart and she does all these little structural changes that then allow stuff to flow. And I prefer that style than some of the grandstanding stuff. I think I'm not saying either's better or worse, but for me personally, I just like her focus and her laser-likeness. Laser-likeness.
Talking about leaders, but how do you be a good leader in this type of environment where there's not turnover as such, but a transient type of employee force, where you might have 100 people come into your workplace for a month and then half of them might leave.
Yeah.
How do you establish culture in an environment like that?
Yeah. Culture's a big thing. So I'll probably go to a Sun Tzu thing. Oh, so cliche, it hurts.
But as we all say, cliches are often true. Often true.
I think it was him who said it. I actually don't know if he said it, but I'm going to give it to him.
Well, everyone's kind of read It's Art of War, isn't it?
Well, I think was it him who said, first you must master the internal war before you go to real war? I've just butchered that, but the idea that you do it in, you have to sort yourself out first. And there's a wisdom that comes with great leadership. It is, and you can feel it. I don't think I was a very good leader for the first 15 years of my career, because I was grappling with empathy and ethics and productivity, and I didn't really know how to bring all the bits together. So it's been relatively recently that I feel like I've got my own version of that, my own character. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm strong on my conviction. And I'm also happy to get hurt to hold my conviction, which I think is why I like Steve Jobs. They're all prepared to go in like almost self-defense against the cop, you know, it's a feeling of I'm going to get hurt, but it's all right. Cause what I'm holding on to is more important. And that to me is quite a big shift as a leader. To answer your question about the new style of leadership. Oh my God. It is hard.
Will culture be as important when it's about outcomes? You're transacting and you want an outcome and.
Yeah. I reckon it's actually more important now. Ethics are more important and culture. To be a leader, you actually have to be quite prepared to not just praise people and make everyone feel happy and all that. You also have to be brave enough to be able to pick up the shitheads. And that's really hard. You know, and there's actually the other thing is there's not a lot of management theory in Australia. Most of it's imported by America and the UK. You know, it's all flavoured with their culture. So for us Aussies, we're finding it really hard to be able to go to a book that says this is proper management theory for Australia. Yeah, it's very different. But I do think you got to figure out yourself and then bring all the bits.
It just occurred to me that I'd love to know what you were like, I guess, as a student in the early days or with all these kind of attributes, you know, was it hard to know where to begin or?
I think I must have been really annoying in hindsight. There's a really funny story, which my mum won't find funny, but I think it's funny. I was quite a naughty child or bored. I didn't have a lot of supervision. So I think they call it like
non-directive teachings.
I think I give it some nice, actually no, my parents just went around, so I used to just get up to bad shit. And I used to get up to all sorts of bad shit that a lot of them still don't know. But there was this one particular, one of the things my parents both really put into me is about being resourceful, probably to their detriment, but they will very much look after yourself, not in a combative way, but use your noggin before anything else. And there was this one time I was being punished for something I'd done. I can't remember what it was, but, I wasn't allowed to watch the TV and that but mum had to go out. So she took the fuse boxes with her and I go, see ya. I had no remorse. I probably had some issues. So when she left, I just rewired the fuses and then left them on. So when she came in, can you imagine what a Satan child I was? She's driven up and I'm just sitting there with the TV and all the lights on just to go, look what I did.
It's genius.
And evil at the same time.
I know. And I think about it now, if my son did that, I'd be like, yeah, nah. You're an evil child. But that's that.
Might be a good example that the writing was on the wall even back then.
That I was...
resourceful and
genius,
yeah,
evil. I know. I felt I think the other thing, I've always been incredibly curious. I think leadership now has to be, you have to be able to amplify your natural curiosity. I know some of the guys here think I'm a bit childish, immature maybe. It's not that. It's the curiosity thing that I think they misinterpret, a willingness to just explore things and people. I think, I don't know, might be that I...
And you're a maths geek.
Yeah, and I was really shit at maths in year 11.
How does that work?
You being really shit was probably in your advanced maths and you got a C.
Yeah.
Being really shit I didn't do maths.
Isn't maths like you've either got it or you don't?
No, no, I wasn't that great at it, funny enough, because a lot of maths is taught as rote and I don't learn very well by rote. I need to explore and figure it out. And I was only talking about this actually this week with a girlfriend who's a teacher going, and I said, maths should be taught like learning piano. Because if you have to do scales every day, you won't love piano. You don't get it. You don't love it. But if you listen to Eric Clapton or you listen to Rachmaninoff and you go, no, you're on the journey to that, you get motivated. And then you can see why scales are important. But I don't reckon we teach our kids that.
But also there was
Eric Clapton is guitar, isn't he?
Yeah,
sorry.
I was like, did he play piano?
I'm sure he did. He's very clever.
I'm sure he would have.
This is makeup.
All,
he did.
All musicians can, dabble in other instruments.
Sure he did.
But also too, I felt with maths that, they kept pounding you. It's a building block subject. If you miss one little piece, well, you might as well give up because you're just never going to get the rest of it.
Yeah.
And there was, there was no kind of entry point if you didn't fit that building block mentality. And so how do you pick it up in a more mature part of your life, or how do you follow it? How did you find the passion to follow it later on or get into it?
I had to. One, stop listening to people who told me I wasn't good at it. That's probably number one. Or people who stereotype, because I'm also good at like drama and theatre and the arts. So my stubbornness, I wanted to be an and right from the beginning. I wanted to be good at this and that. But I think in math, it's easy to get really disillusioned really quickly when people tell you that you're not good at it. And the fact is you actually do have to practice a lot. And if you're already in your head that you think you've got this limiting thought that you already have been told you're not good at it, you're not going to find that extra, that energy to stick it in your head. But I gave all that. I stopped listening to people probably actually about 5 years old. But thanks, Mum.
I didn't realise that maths had a gender slant.
Nor did I. I didn't know either. But apparently it does. Apparently men are better at math than ladies.
Yeah?
Yeah, you can internet that one. Google it.
I'll look that up.
Well, you're bucking the trend. I can't help. I have to pick up and we're going to have to shape the conversation because we understand this is a Friday afternoon.
I know.
And you're probably dying for a wine.
Yeah.
But crypto.
Oh, yeah.
It's a buzzword at the moment.
It is.
What is it in the best possible summary?
Yeah.
Why are you interested in it?
Right, what is it? So it's really hard to explain that. The cryptocurrency is a transaction, like an application that sits across this blockchain world. And it's a way to use the blockchain application to do stuff on it. And people are trying to grapple, trying to get their heads around, like, why is Bitcoin? They're trying to compare Bitcoin to gold currency. And they're going, and they're putting it through that lens. I reckon it's better, personally, to think of crypto and that world as more like loyalty points, because, like, loyalty points, like frequent flyer points, they're unencumbered by supply and demand. You can just produce them more and more and more, and that's which is cool. And the value, relative value of where you choose to put your loyalty points will depend on the branding, the sentiment of the market, which looks a lot like trading, and loyalty points have value, they spit out the other end on it. And in some ways, crypto looks a bit more like that, shares some characteristics on it.
You're studying blockchain, so you obviously see that it's going to be a massive part of the future.
Yeah.
I'm assuming.
Yeah, there's a bit of smoke and mirrors in there as well.
So you're studying it to see if it's legit?
I'm studying it. So every year from a career planning point of view, I choose something to improve myself. Last year I did marketing, which was extraordinary. I bend my brain into that. This year is back to technology, and I'm leading the jungles has got some ambitious plans on it. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors, a lot with it. The application, the true commercial value of blockchain at the moment is quite limited, quite limited. A lot of people don't understand that. It's very trendy. So there's going to be a lot of consulting money to be had, and I'm happy to be employed by anyone who would like me to, but it's very, very tiny part of the world that will be successfully blockchained. Yeah.
Okay.
At the moment. I don't know. I could talk for hours on that one.
No, that's a separate
topic. So the fact that a lot of people are making money from it is not a reflection actually at the moment of really where the benefits are.
No, I'm old enough to remember what dot-coms look like. There's a whole lot of dot-com-ness about this. In fact, the dudes walking in when they were doing the pitch, I went, I reckon they might have been around the first time and they've spent all their money and they're back. There is a bit of that to it. There are some really powerful applications for it, but a lot of it will be augmented. So, I mean, one of the problems with IoT appliances is security, as an example. And that's just an issue, you know, like a solar panel.
Mm.
There's some really good uses of blockchain where you create private networks and the appliances can talk to each other and keep them verified. That's a really simple application. That makes sense.
Mm.
But smart contracts, they're not recognised in courts of law. And they're one way. You can't back out of them. A few little structural issues at the moment. Yeah, but they'll get there.
Yeah. Marina, we tend to finish our interviews with rapid fire. So we're going to do about a minute of questions, short answers,
okay.
And these are unscripted, so we're just going to go off the cuff. My first question, seeing as you're a high achiever in every aspect, what is your greatest flaw?
Not knowing when to give up.
No, that's one of those strengths couched
no,
as
it's
a negative.
Not. No, it's not. No,
so what's the negative effect of that?
No, it's not. No, trust me. I keep going. Like, I've been called a pit pony where I am still going when everyone's going, dude, party's over. And that inability to switch off when it's over is actually pretty serious.
And you're not literally talking about parties.
Maybe. I'm pretty much the last one there as well. Like, there is a real art in knowing when to walk away.
Yep.
If you could choose a completely different and irrelevant career path or business, what would you love to just throw yourself into?
Everyone knows film directing.
Favourite movie? Two movies?
Big fan of The Godfather, of all of that stuff, because all the and I still love a Eraserhead. Yeah, I do. I still love it. Oh, yeah.
Favourite piece of music?
Oh, anything Chopin or Rachmaninoff or Roger Waters. I just went at Pink Floyd. Yeah.
What would you be doing if you weren't building your business?
Buying water. I like water trading as well.
Kidding.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. Yeah.
Okay. Next one. Last question then. Seeing as you're a high achiever and you're into all these kind of intellectual things, what's the biggest vice that you have? The kind of like, you know, the cheesiest thing you do?
I always watch maths and love reading like just crap. New idea. All that crap. I love all that shit. I love it.
That's awesome.
I don't like Kardashians, but.
Do you? Well, I'm glad that you're up with Beck Goddard. Beck Hewitt. No, Beck Hewitt and her pregnancy status is usually kind of.
Oh, I missed that one.
She's not. She's never pregnant, but, you know, New Idea always says she is. But
yeah, I travel. Yeah, missed out. Yeah,
Well, Marie, thank you for giving up your time. I think you're an and sort of person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been great to get an insight into your world, your mind. And I can't wait to see some of the things that you are beginning really take hold and gather some momentum. So thanks for your time on Rooster Radio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio with Marina Pullen. check out mcbi.com.au for more information. We have plenty of interesting interviews in the bank and many more to come, so subscribe to Rooster Radio. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on your favourite podcast player and connect with us at roosterradio.biz. We'd love to hear from you.